Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an illustrator, educator, comics artist, and author of the new graphic novel, Odessa. Jonathan Hill, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are currently in the midst of the annual Portland Book Festival, and you're participating in a number of events. This year's festival is dramatically different from previous year's events.
Yeah, I mean, just like everything else, it's gone completely virtual. I had my event with Kiku Hughes on Saturday, and yeah, the theme was aftershocks, and it was pairing sort of the dystopian past and then sort of the dystopian future of my book in YA.
Yeah, it's interesting that the book festival is normally a day-long event, and now it's a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I also serve on the board of directors for Literary Arts, and you know, Amanda Bullock and Liz Olofsson are in charge of kind of running the book festival. And I think Literary Arts has had to pivot, just like everywhere else, of just having to move remotely. And I think something that I just really appreciate when they think about how they're having to adapt and how they have to change is looking at opportunities instead of just trying to sort of cram in what was the one day of the book festival. Let's try to cram it into an online event in one day, but looking at like, well, we won't run any events concurrently so that people could experience every single event. We'll record them. We have a wider audience that we can reach, and just trying to get as many authors and creators involved. And so I think, I don't want to speak for Amanda. I don't want to speak for Liz or anyone that ran it, but I think that it really was just looking at, you know, how things have changed and how we can take advantage of that.
Well, your being on the board of Literary Arts is a testament to the fact that ever since its beginnings as the Wordstock Festival, the Portland Book Festival has always embraced comics and graphic novels.
Yeah, I think one of my first big events was actually at the Book Fest. This would have been 2011, or it was Wordstock at the time, obviously, and it was the convention center. And I think I did an event for my first book, Americus, and I was there with Vera Brosgel. Anya's Ghost had just come out that year, and we did a talk together. So yeah, I've been involved on and off. You know, that was the first thing I did with Wordstock, and then I think it went dormant for a little bit, and then Literary Arts sort of took over and turned it into the Book Fest. And then I've kind of been involved every year since then, since Literary Arts took it over.
Well, this is a good time to mention, you collaborated with M.K. Reed, she's another Portland comics creator, on two books, Americus and Wild Weather. So yeah, tell us a little bit about those projects and your working relationship. I know it was definitely an evolving thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, with Americus, I mean, if anyone has heard me talk about it before, you know, we were kind of connected through Greg Means, who semi-runs Tugboat Press anymore. I don't think he really has published anything in a really long time, but he used to publish Paper Cutter, which is probably the best comics anthology, I think, that's ever been printed, because he just did such a good job of getting established cartoonists and new voices and stuff. But MK and I had never worked together. And I think if you read through Americus, you can actually see that relationship growing. I think if you look specifically at the first chapter of Americus, the layouts are not, I'm very particular and very intentional about my layouts and my storytelling. And MK is very good at like dialogue, but the thing is you have a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of space for the artist to sort of play. And so I think in that first chapter, it was me trying to really fit her stuff into a space. And, you know, I think as the book goes, we sort of learn what it took to work with each other. And the metaphor I would use is it's like if you were to dance with a stranger, you're going to be stepping on their feet. It's going to be awkward. It's going to be clunky. But the more that you do it, the more in sync you're going to get. And it's a really great thing to be able to work with someone and sort of like trust them, trust that the best interest of the book and the story are there, and that we're just doing what we can to make it the best that it can be. That was a lot of fun. It was a big deal to have that be my first book. You know, at first I was kind of unsure about working with somebody else, but I was eventually just like, well, I'm not drawing my own book now, so I might as well do it. And I learned so much. Honestly, I think the biggest thing I learned from those first two books with MK is like learning to let go. Because I think when you work on your own, you can be very particular and you can fuss with it until it's perfect. But when you're working with somebody else, you kind of have to give a little bit to get it done. And I think that was really helpful for me in just learning to just like let go, get the pages done and move forward, because that's the most important thing.
So let's talk about Odessa. This is your first solo graphic novel, and the title Odessa refers to a certain person, a character in the book.
Yeah, so it's the book is about three siblings searching for their estranged mother across the ruins of America, and their mother's name is Odessa. And it sort of starts off where the oldest sibling, Virginia, gets a package from their mother, and they don't know if she's been dead or alive. They haven't heard from her in years. And this sort of spurs this adventure and her sort of taking the initiative to try to risk leaving everything that she knows behind, you know, just for that chance to find her mother. And the book was actually originally called The Searchers, which I hope I wasn't like buzz killing you if you were going to ask about that. But
no, I'm wondering if you're a John Ford fan, fan of John Ford movies.
Yeah, and I am. And I mean, I think I was more into them when I was in college. But I really like that title. I like that it was sort of a reference to that movie, that John Ford, John Wayne film. But I also like that there was sort of a simpleness and unpretentiousness to that title, of sort of like thinking of other books like, you know, The Rescuers, The Leavers by Lisa Coe, which isn't a YA book, but just like, I liked that sort of, it really just got to the point. And that was a working title for a really long time. And then when it got closer to the book coming out, I think the marketing folks at Oni were like, it's just going to cause a marketing headache that we don't need. You know, they knew I was really attached because I had called it that for years while I was working on it. But me and my editor, Robin Herrera, we had some brainstorming sessions, and Odessa came up, and now it's just, I can't see it being anything else. And I think Odessa just fits so perfectly because it's the character's name, but also there's, you know, Odessa sort of deriving from the Odyssey and that journey and that long track. And so I think it ended up exactly where it needed to be.
Well, you mentioned the protagonist. Her name is Virginia Crane. Ginny, as her family calls her, is a 17-year-old girl. And The Cranes are a Vietnamese American family living in Portland. So, you know, obviously you're drawing on some of your own cultural experience there.
Yeah, I think I actually just last week I did a blog post for We Need Diverse Books, and it sort of talks about the, you know, they were sending out galleys and everything, and against everyone's advice and my better judgment, I would look at Goodreads and see, you know, what people were saying. And there were some reviews that were like a 1-star review, and I could take it, but they were like, it's Vietnamese American, but that doesn't play into the plot at all. And it was actually, that was really upsetting for me. I don't mind getting a 1-star review. I know that, you know, everybody has their own taste and you'll get whatever you get from the story. But I think I really took offense to that sort of idea. And there were other reviews that had sort of come up similar to that. That there's just this idea of that to be Vietnamese American, their heritage or their culture had to tie into it. I think the fact that people were saying that shows how much we need diversity in media, because they're Vietnamese American because I'm Vietnamese American. And I was raised in, you know, the more of the dominant culture. I'm mixed. My mother's Vietnamese. My dad is American, and I grew up American. But I mean, it's beating a dead horse at this point to say that, you know, who were the options I had in representation in media? Short Round, Long Duk Dong, that sort of stuff. Like, that's, you know, it's a sidekick or it's a farce. And I didn't have anybody to look up to. You know, I know before the interview started, we talked about Big Trouble in Little China. That was the most important movie for me growing up, because I loved that it sort of inverted the tropes there, and that Jack Burton he's sort of the sidekick, and it's really Wang Chi who's the main character. He's the one who's, you know, fiance has been kidnapped. He's the one that's competent. He's the one. And Jack Burton is sort of like this fumbling sort of goofball who he thinks he's the main character. And I think it was huge for me when I was a kid growing up with that movie. And so I just, with them being Vietnamese American, I just wanted them to be able to be like, that they could be the heroes of the story. They could be the protagonists. it doesn't have to tie into the Vietnam War or immigration or that cultural heritage. I want some kid who's Vietnamese American to be able to pick up a book and just read it. And then I also want other people to just read a book and see that, like, oh, here's the main character, and they don't have to be a straight white dude, you know?
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, again, the protagonist of Odessa, Virginia Crane. So you're a guy and you're writing across gender lines. That must have been a challenge at some point for you.
You know, I thought about this, and I wonder, you know, because you also, like, I wonder, like, what, I think at a time when we're trying to be very conscientious of, like, who gets to tell whose story, like, is it my place to, like, write a 16-year-old girl or a 17-year-old girl? But I think ultimately, you know, as a creative, I think I'm just sort of a comics engineer. I'm a story engineer. I look at problem solving. I come up with plot things. Those create problems. I have to solve those problems. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, Virginia is a 16-year-old girl, but I also think that really she's just the character Virginia Crane. And I think the choice to make her a girl was a couple reasons. I think that one of the reasons is I feel like on a level of having a mother have left, having the oldest sibling be the daughter, who was the one who was oldest and had the strongest connection and is forced into sort of a matriarchal role against her will or unknowingly just because of the survival of this world and with the mother leaving, I felt like that created a little bit of a stronger connection. And like what it's like to have to take care of people, have to have your childhood sort of taken as you had to become more responsible, that sort of thing. So that's how I tried to treat her. And I hope that people can read about her character and just have her feel real and not really care if she's a girl or a boy or binary or, you know, whatever. Like, just like, I think that she exists kind of just as a character.
In Odessa, the end of the world in the story comes about because of the big one, a massive earthquake along the West Coast. And as the story unfolds, we find that the earthquake isn't the only thing that's brought down civilization.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I don't know if I want to be too spoilery, but essentially there's a supernatural element to it that kind of comes in later.
It's a little bit sci-fi, yeah.
I think it was intentionally a little bit of a slow burn. It's funny because I think my editor, Robin, she had read the pitch and she had wanted to work on it. And I think when I was sending her pages or thumbnails for her to kind of check over to make sure everything's okay. I think she'd forgotten that there was that element to it. And it was interesting to have her reading it as I was turning pages in and just sort of being like, thinking it was, oh, it's the big one. But then there ended up being the supernatural element. It kind of took her by surprise. And so I kind of hope that it just unfolds in that same way for the reader too, is that, you know, you think it's just sort of the big one that we talk about, that we read about, all that sort of thing. But I wanted there to be something a little bit different to it.
Well, there's definitely some allegorical elements. I mean, one of the things that people worry about these days is that we've been weakening the structures of our civilization so that, one big push could just topple things.
And I think that is, it's funny because as I was working on this book, I had a former student, Zan Drake. They were an art assistant. So they helped me do things like just like reletter it in Illustrator, kind of prep it for print so that I wouldn't have to do that, so I could keep working pages. And Zan is great. Shout out to Zan. But what I really appreciate about them is we were talking about it once and they were like, I don't know if this is intentional, but I noticed this theme in the book that sort of has come up and it really resonated with them. And that, I mean, it's playing to a lot of apocalyptic story tropes, like it's ruthless, it's violent, there's gangs or different factions that are sort of vying for power and position. But then they're also like, at the beginning, the story starts out and it's like, they're in Portland and it's more like a community and it's homesteaded and it's sort of sheltered from the outside, from California, essentially. And, you know, it's just violence and violence. And that's the rule of law, right? It's like you survive. That's the only thing that matters. And Virginia and her brothers sort of butt up against that. And I think there are some conflicts within them, with even the siblings amongst that. But, you know, Zan just really appreciated that there's this idea of all these grown-ups are saying, like, this is the rule of California. This is the rule of the straight. It's kill or be killed. And the kids are like, but it doesn't have to be like that. And, you know, just this idea of these structures that are in place that we think are, and I think this is what's been happening the last, what, 8 months now, 9 months of, like, we're seeing that these systems, like, they're actually really bad systems. They're kind of a facade, and they're in place because that's the way they are. And so, you know, what it must be like, you know, because I teach at the college level, I teach youth too. But to just be handed this world that grownups are just like, it's horrible. It's over. We don't care. We've burnt it. We've raised it. We took what we wanted, but now you're going to inherit it. And there's no other way to live. What is that like? That's really, it's horrible for us to be doing that. And so what it must be like for a teenager or a 20-year-old or college student to be handed that and be like, well, those ways don't have to be that. That's not the way you have to do it. And so I don't even think that was something I was kind of conscious of, but it was something that I was like, oh yeah, that, like, it was kind of cool to hear that sort of interpretation of some of the story.
Yeah, we've been seeing so many young people that have stepped forward. I mean, the Parkland High School kids, Malala Yousafzai and Greta Thunberg. There's this kind of almost mythical moment that we're in right now with these young people stepping up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I love working with youth. I love working with my students. And just to see them tell stories and see them tell their stories, I just get excited to read good comics. And again, there's an activism amongst them because they're handed this husk of a world that, you know, they're going to have to live off of. And that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. And so I just, I think it's great.
So the post-apocalyptic backgrounds and landscapes in your book, they're almost like a character themselves. Your world building is really sophisticated.
Thanks. That actually, it's, I feel like I can't say that, but I feel like having somebody else say that to me makes me feel really great because it's kind of interesting. A lot of that sort of visual language is sort of just built out of anxiety or nervousness of, like, not being comfortable leaving negative space or empty space. And, like, really, you know, I think that's something I was really, really conscious of is I feel like, I want it to feel like a place. I want it to feel like, you know, does Portland feel different from San Francisco? They're on a road trip. It's contemporary times, et cetera, et cetera. I can find photo reference to places that they're going to be, and I can just sort of draw from that. But to be like, okay, I need to find these places and have them be destroyed, have it be a new place. How do I make that look real? Of course, hopefully, you know, there is an inspiration from some of those Westerns. And I think even like old manga, like Lone Wolf and Cub, of him traveling, the sort of quiet moments of him traveling the countryside and stuff like that. So those are definitely the roots to that, that imagery.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And I'm talking today with Jonathan Hill. He's an illustrator, educator, comics artist, and author of the graphic novel, Odessa. So, Jonathan, would you like to do a reading from Odessa?
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I think I have a scene here that might work out pretty well. This scene sort of starts off as Virginia pulls out sort of the letter and the photo that her mother has sent her, but it kind of spurs all of the book, really. And off panel, we have TK. So let me ask you something. You don't know if your mother is in San Francisco, but you hope to find her there? Virginia responds, well, we have an uncle there and she lived with them a long time ago. We thought she might still be with him. TK asks, but you know she's alive? And Virginia says, I got some posts from her on my birthday. Unfortunately, it doesn't say where it came from. TK says, is that what you have there? Virginia holds up the photo. Yeah, she sent an old picture of me when I was a kid. Could I see it? Sure. You were a cute kid. Thanks. Your brothers have her nose. Yeah, I got stuck with our dads. your kids. So they're there's a quiet pause as they both look at the fire. They died during the earthquakes. Well, one of them did. The eldest survived, but had an accident a year later. I tried to save them, but it made things worse, much worse. It would have been better if they passed with their sister. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. No, it's fine. It's in the past. I've made my peace. Do you remember that day? Virginia says, "You mean the earthquakes?" Of course. I was about Harry's age. It seemed like the ground would never stop shaking. And TK says, "Yep, it was worse down here in California. Some of the shaking you felt was the earth tearing itself open and forming the strait. The world ended, right? But it didn't. We're still here. Things never end, they just change." And that's the end of the section.
A lot of the action in Odessa, it takes place on the water. And the fault line that's opened up after the earthquake, it created a massive waterway across California called the Strait. And the Strait is full of ramshackle boats traveling between the north and the south, smuggler boats, refugee boats.
Yeah, and it's basically split up between two gangs. There's the Wing Kong, which is a reference to Big Trouble in Little China, and then the Gogu in the south. And that's sort of the lifeline of how everything travels in this new world. And that was something that I really liked that idea. Growing up, you'd have jokes of like, oh, my dad lived in when I was in college, my dad moved to the Inland Empire, so like Victorville, Apple Valley, California. And, there's lots of, oh, when the big one hits the San Andreas Fault, like this will be beachfront property, et cetera, et cetera. So, you just grow up hearing those jokes. And I think when I was world building, I was like, well, like, I really like that idea. I really like this, this, I mean, again, there's no science behind it at all, but just this idea of like California breaking off into the ocean. And then, just trying to think of, well, what would that create, like if highways are broken, if there's not really ways to travel, that waterway is going to be the main source of commerce and communication and all of that sort of things. So that's sort of how that came about. But something I kind of didn't anticipate until I started thumbing it out is that means I'm going to have to draw boats for about 200 pages. And I pretty sure I could count the times I drew a boat on one hand in my 20-year career. So that was definitely something that was a big challenge. But that's comics, right? Like, I'm not going to change the story to fit my aversion to drawing boats. I'm going to just like cartoonist up and learn how to draw some boats.
Yeah, and you mentioned the rival gangs. The Strait is being fought over by the Wing Kong on one hand, a reference to Big Trouble in Little China, and the Gogu on the other. And there seems to be not just a geographical conflict between the two gangs, but also a cultural conflict.
Yeah, the idea of the Wing Kong was sort of, again, it was very inspired by Big Trouble in Little China, that there would be like this, basically a triad that would be in San Francisco. And as the world sort of was destroyed, this triad is going to have the ruthlessness, the resources, and that sort of mindset of like, well, now this is a new world and we're going to create it in our own image. And that image is going to be one of, yeah, like, violence and smuggling and sort of taking that over. And the idea, I guess, being the Gogu is that, so they're sort of like a more unified front, and the Gogu just end up being sort of like a ragtag sort of collections of maybe different peoples in that you might find, like, that like Southern California, Los Angeles is such like has such a diverse community of people from all over. And so the idea of the Gogu would be sort of like pulling people from those different, those communities and those groups and sort of being united under one sort of leader. So that was the idea. Again, there's a whole lot of world building that goes into it that you come up with, but maybe doesn't show up in the comic. And so, it's interesting for me. Like, I'm actually working on some project, like a project right now, and some thinking of some ways that like you have all this world building, and how can you kind of show it to the world, or how can you expand on that?
When you mentioned the challenge of drawing boats, I'm reminded of a comic that you created for the Believer magazine. You wrote about your mother and your uncle, their escape from Vietnam. And the boat you drew in that comic was very similar looking to some of the boats in Odessa.
Yeah, you know, I think that was probably just like a reference, just like using a simple photo reference. I think, you know, I don't know that it was intentional. I think it was just like maybe I was working on Odessa at the time I did that Believer story. So it could have just been, it could be a boat straight out of Odessa that I needed a boat. And so I just shorthand, just redrew one of the boats that I had drawn in Odessa.
So you weren't necessarily thinking about refugees, these kids being taken aboard the boat to go on this odyssey across the water in the way that your mother and your uncle did.
You were hoping that there was a connection there. It wasn't really. I think again, it almost purely came from just like storytelling of like, okay, I created this world. The strait exists. This is the waterway they need to get from point A to point B. They're not going to ride horses. They're going to be like the boats are the main source of commerce here. And also it was something I thought of just in terms of world building of like, if there's this waterway, the boats might have survived from this earthquake and this, you know, like, as opposed to, you know, their vehicles or things, there are some boats in the book that are inspired by other boats. Like, the movie Beasts of the Southern Wild. I can't remember the director of that movie, but I just love that one of the boats is just these empty barrels and then the back of a truck and a motor on it. And so at one point they meet sort of this person in the water to supply up. And their boat is ripped off straightly from Beasts of the Southern Wild to just so that there's idea that there would be boats that people had, that boats existed in the world, but there would also be boats that people would have made and, you know, thrown things together. And again, I think that was another big part of the world building was just this idea of like, okay, there's no new manufacturing, there's no new things. So we're having to take things that already exist and kind of compile them together.
Well, I did want to probe a little bit more into that comic for the Believer, because that's a 4-page comic where you're really kind of grappling with your Vietnamese American heritage, and you're portraying yourself as a kid who's not appreciating all of the things that your mom who's escaped Vietnam and brought this culture with her. There's a bit of regret in some of those comics for the way you reacted to some of the overtures that she gave to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, growing up, you don't want to be different, right? You want to fit in. And I grew up kind of all over the world. I spent most of my adolescence, you know, my youth, probably up until about seventh grade in Missouri and Colorado. I'm surrounded by white kids. I don't want to be different. I don't want to be the person that, you know, and I think that I speak to this in the comic is that amongst whites and the dominant culture, I stand out because I look different, but I grew up the same way that they grew up. But then if I'm amongst Vietnamese, I don't speak the language. I'm half white. I'm not Vietnamese enough. We mostly grew up mostly American culture. There were some Vietnamese things that we had growing up, but sometimes there'd be food that'd be too weird or sick of eating. You know, I remember when the rest of my family came over from Vietnam and they were all living with us in this small house. Well, I mean, it was actually a pretty big house, but, you know, just this huge family. And, you know, we had to eat Vietnamese food every day, or like we might have pizza, but then we'd have to eat rice and this other stuff. And, you know, I'm just like, God, I'm sick of eating rice. I'm sick of having rice all the time. And, you know, you just don't appreciate it because when we're kids, we're just totally absorbed in ourselves. And it's not until I grow up. And I mean, that whole comic is growing up and being like, what does it mean to be Vietnamese American? Like, I wish I could connect more with that. I wish I would have paid attention. You know, I didn't grow up, my mom obviously speaks Vietnamese. She teaches Vietnamese language at UCSD. My dad spoke fluent Vietnamese, but we didn't grow up speaking Vietnamese. You know, I wish that I would have pushed for that more. But as a kid, like, you know, you don't care. You just want to eat pizza and watch TV and like hang out with your friends. You don't have an appreciation for that. And I think that's just not me culturally, but I think that's kids in general. I mean, how many of us were kids that our parents spent so much time and money taking us on vacations and all we wanted to do is stay in the hotel and watch cartoons or something. And you grow up and you have kids, or you grow up and you see other kids and you're just like, you just think about what it took for your parents to do that for you, to try to create moments and memories. And you were just like you were a turd. You were just like a little brat. And I think that for me, that just comes up culturally and just being like, I just think about what my mom has gone through and how much, like, I wish I could connect to her in a lot of ways like that. You know, so that's what that comic is about. Is that comic is about that sort of, it's a love letter to that, for that regret, I guess, is what it was.
As an adult, did you ever get a chance to visit Vietnam?
Yeah, you know, we went a couple of years, actually, I guess it was 10 years ago. We went, and we were cheating a little bit because we did go with my mom. So we didn't have to learn the language or anything because she just served as a translator. And it was great to see, you know, because there is a big part of my family history in there, not just for my mom, but my dad. He was in Vietnam since before the war. And he was there up until the end. He was on one of the last helicopters out. And so he was there for a very, very long time. And so that was probably his favorite place in the world. And so it was really intense to go and have my mom. I'm really glad that we got to go with her and have her show us, this is this place from our youth. This is this place, you know, your dad worked here, et cetera, et cetera. It was a really, really great experience.
And just to make the cultural mix more interesting, you ended up spending your teenage years in Kuwait.
I did. My dad's company, they were a contractor for the Army. So we moved around like Army brats without being Army brats. Those kids are horrible. But so we moved around every 4 years. And so, yeah, in the middle of my seventh grade year, we moved from Rolla, Missouri, which is right in the middle of Missouri. We moved to Kuwait and I spent all of high school there. And yeah, I think it was probably one of the, you know, of course, again, I was a kid. It's when we first moved, I didn't want to move away from my friends, everything that I've known. I didn't want to have to go to a new, you know, a new place, a new country, a new school, a new culture, all that sort of stuff. But of course, looking back, I think it was probably one of like the biggest experiences of my life. And it's funny too, looking back and just realizing where I was when we moved, I was actually horrible. I was in a horrible place. I was depressed. It was sort of, you know, seventh grade can be a time where friends sort of start to separate. I just wasn't happy. And I think moving to Kuwait helped me in a really, really big way in terms of like, it was such a smaller community. It was such a more diverse community. I think it really helped me. I mean, obviously just see the world, but just like kind of come into my own. Yeah, it was one of my books. I decided as I'm writing my own books, I just want to do love letters to all these important things in my life. Odessa is a love letter to my brothers. I would love to do a book that is a love letter to all my friends and the experiences there. But, you know, there's not enough time in the day. And maybe down the road, that'll be one of my books.
How soon after the first Gulf War were you in Kuwait? I'm wondering what effect you kind of sensed from.
Yeah, that. You know, so I think we were there like 3 years later. And, you know, I remember when the Gulf War was happening and I remember watching on the news sort of the missile strikes. And I remember seeing the Kuwaiti families sort of hiding and hunkering. And I remember, you know, I think I was old enough at that point that I was just like, that seems like the scariest thing ever. And that sort of stuck with me. And then I remember when my dad was like, all right, we're moving overseas. We're going to Kuwait. I was just like, oh my God, that like, what? But you couldn't even tell basically that there was a war. There were some buildings that they left, I think as sort of like memorials to what happened, but you, for day-to-day life, you couldn't even tell that there was a war there.
And did you get to travel around the region a bit?
Yeah, we did. We had, what was it called? Like Mediterranean Activities Conference. So like you would go to, you know, Cairo for basketball, or you'd go to Dubai for a basketball tournament or things like that. Like our model, I know that kids here have MUN, Model United Nations, and that's a joke because when we went, we would go to The Hague for MUN, like the actual Hague. But I didn't do sports. I basically did, we had a fine arts festival, and so I would travel there. So we did some traveling around. When I moved away to go to college, my brothers and my dad did a lot of traveling through Asia and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's just a huge opportunity, right? To just see a different part of the world and just experience a different part of the world.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with Jonathan Hill. He's an illustrator, educator, comics artist, and author of the graphic novel Odessa. You have a very traditional sort of black and white kind of line work for your comics. And in Odessa, you bring in a spot color.
Thanks. Yeah, the spot color, I think I get a lot of questions about the spot color. And I think this is somewhere where some of it, again, like I said, is just the problem solving. But some of it is an artistic choice. And, you know, I think on a practical level, the spot color, it saves time because it saves time versus full color, but I can still define forms, depth, that sort of thing. But, you know, there also is a choice. There also is a decision for that too, and sort of in comics. And I've edited books. I teach class, and I talk about the importance of spot color. I'm inspired by a lot of folks that do a single color. Some of the answer is too, is like, I think comics exist in the space in between. So, I mean, literally there's a space in between one image to another. You get the reader gets to put what they want into, you know, how does that look in between that space? There's the space in between the words and the pictures. You know, what does that sound like? You're reading them at the same time. And I think, you know, a spot color works in that same way, in that, again, you can imply things, but the reader is getting to sort of put together, what does the image look like? What would this look like in full color? Or is it a filter or something? And so I feel like it's kind of a pretentious answer, but I also feel like a spot color is kind of comics' best form, as opposed to full color or black and white, because, I mean, black and white is still great. I love black and white, but there's just so many more things you can do with a spot color while still maintaining that sort of like space in between.
And in the case of Odessa, it's a warm color. You know, it's not a cold color. So you're using this reddish color to go along with this post-apocalyptic story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a pink. And I think that, again, there's a couple choices for that. Again, like, I'm such a pragmatist, I think some of these answers are so boring, but it when you pick a spot color, you need it to be like a lighter midtone. You don't want it to be darker, because if it's darker, your line work is going to dissolve into that color and it's going to compete with it, and you're not going to be able to see the lines. So by picking a lighter midtone, you have the white, the black, and then the midtone in between. But the pink was, you know, there's so many post-apocalyptic stories where just gray, it's drab, it's brown. And like, the world isn't like that. You know, you can look at places in the world where maybe things have been abandoned, or a big reference for the work too was Detroit Disassembled. It's this photography book of, I can't remember the photographer, but he went into all these abandoned places in Detroit and just took photographs of it. And it's post-apocalyptic, but it's so beautiful, so beautiful. And that was like a huge influence on sort of the look of it. But it, again, like, the world isn't brown or gray or drab. It's so colorful. And I think there's also like a machismo in post-apocalyptic stories of, again, that violence, that survival, that strength wins. And I wanted to subvert that. I wanted to juxtapose that with what we think of like a feminine color of pink. You know, I wanted to sort of flip that on its head, and it served as a nice midtone. And it kind of was the furthest away from that, you know, macho, dark, gray grab that you might think about it. So those were sort of the choices behind that that pink color.
If you think back over your influences, you know, not just artistic influences, but also literary influences, storytelling influences. Like, who's made some of the biggest marks on you, do you think?
I think in terms of comics, Kevin Huizenga, I can't remember if I'm saying his name right.
Oh, Huizenga.
Huizenga, yeah.
Yeah, we've had him on the show. He's great.
Yeah, he's probably one of the, he was here for the book festival last year. He was probably one of the biggest influences on me, and in terms of time, how he uses time. And I think it, you know, you could read his stuff, you could read my stuff, and you might not see that connection, but I was introduced to him when I was in college, when he was just first starting out, and my professor, Ted Stern, who would also be, he was probably the biggest influence on me. My mentor, Ted Stern, but just like, yeah, just how he uses time. And I think you can see that in Odessa, in sort of the transitions between places. I think the influence there, and then the influence, you can also see the influence from Lone Wolf and Cub. It's just like quiet moments, setting up the scene, I love sometimes in some of the action too, it's not sort of like ABC. It's sort of like there's a quiet moment in between some violence. And it's like, is that happening before or after this violence is taking place? And again, it's doing it in not such a straightforward way. And I think that's sort of the biggest influence on me as a cartoonist. I grew up on Lord of the Rings. My uncle, who was my mother's brother, he lived with us growing up, and he was probably one of the biggest influences on me too. And, you know, we would go camping and he would recite the Lord of the Rings from memory. He would just tell the story as if it were a story that he had made up or that he had known. And it was this sort of oral tradition that was so powerful for us. And I think there was one summer that we ended up staying with him when he was living in Utah. And we read through the books together before night. And maybe not like the story I remember and is super powerful to me, but also just that act of telling stories together. And I know this is going to be a really weird one, but I grew up as a gamer. I grew up playing Magic. I didn't really play D&D until I was older, but that was a big influence on me. There was an old game called Legend of the Five Rings. It's set in sort of a pseudo-feudal Japanese setting, and there are these seven clans sort of vying for, you know, the emperor has died, and so they're all he left no heir, and so they're vying for that. And you know, what was interesting is how they told their story, and that it was a card game like Magic, and so story would come out in the rule book, it would come out in the flavor text of cards, it would come out, and so just it was such an interesting way to tell a story, and that it's not like a comic or a movie or a book, and that like here is everything all at once, but it's piecemeal. And it's piecemeal in different places. And this was before the internet had such a strong presence. And so that was probably one of the biggest influences on me in terms of just like different ways you can tell a story and using the medium that you have to use all the strengths of that medium to tell a story. That still sticks with me today. And I think it still sticks with me in the way that I use comics.
Well, you've been teaching comics for a number of years. You teach illustration, visual storytelling at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. For a while, you were also teaching at the late lamented Oregon College of Art and Crafts. Mm-hmm. And Literary Arts, where you're a board member, they have a program called Writers in the Schools.
Yeah. I mean, I stumbled onto teaching in the same way I stumbled onto comics. Is that like, I didn't plan on making comics. I never wanted to make comics my whole life. I went to art school and I had to figure out what I needed to study. I had to think about comics in this like way of the future that I like, how do I make this a job that I never thought about? I went to school for illustration. I went to Savannah College of Art and Design. I was about 2 years in the illustration program and I hated it. It was so boring. I did not know what to do, but a friend of mine, a neighbor, and he ended up being my roommate and close friend, Jason Rainey, he was studying comics and he was like, man, you like to write? You like to draw? Maybe you study comics. And I was like, that sounds like the worst idea ever, but I'm not happy with what I'm doing, so I'll give it a shot. And I just feel like I had teachers there that were like who I needed at right the exact moment. And they were teachers that were like, man, you know, you have work to do, but like, you have something here. And when I was in school, that was just like so important for me. And it's been important my whole life. I feel like I've been blessed in having teachers, like just someone telling you, hey, you can do this. Or like, hey, your voice matters. I'm where I am because of those people. And I think that I just wanted to give back in that way. And when I was at SCAD, I was the director of the art education program where we'd take different majors and take them to schools and in Chatham County who had non-existent or underfunded arts art programs. And we would kind of teach kids there. And then, yeah, I started teaching at OCAC. And I love storytelling. I love people telling good stories. I love good comics. And, you know, in a selfish way, it's all about just like getting good comics out in the world. And that's what I do now. And again, I think that the only thing that I love more than making comics is teaching comics. And I don't know that there's more to it than that.
And what you always hear from people in the teaching profession is that learning is a two-way street, that passing along what knowledge you have, it comes back to you in other ways. Your students sharpen your skills along the way.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think teaching is such a good way I need to know why am I making these decisions? I can tell someone do this and do this, but if I can't tell them why, it's pointless. And so that forces me to sort of melt down and question every sort of thing that I'm doing to come up with that answer. And then it makes me look at my own process and my work in my own way. And even on just sort of like even more superficial levels is, you know, Odessa was all, it was drawn all digitally. That wasn't the intention. It was my first time doing that. The intention was that I would pencil it digitally, print it out on blue line and then ink it. But I was doing my pencils. The first chapter of the book are all pencils. My pencils were so tight. I was showing some of my students and one of my students was like, dude, you're out of your mind. These pencils are so tight. Just color, hold them, turn them to black, and then they're inks. And I was like, oh my God. And I did it. And I just thought of all the time that that would save me because, you know, I was this crusty old man sort of stuck in his ways. And I still miss working with the brush more than anything in the world. But it was just something like just different processes or different ways of thinking. And absolutely, like, I hope that my classes, and again, I can't speak for this. People that have had me in class have to speak for this, but I would hope that it's not a place of me telling them what to do. It's a place of like me sharing my experiences and they're sharing their experiences, their knowledge. And then we can just sort of absolutely learn from each other. You know, that's what I hope is the case.
And you're still doing illustration.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely more of a side thing. I feel like I have a couple clients who just throw me work every now and then. And it's nice to have something different to do. And sometimes, you know, that's the nice thing about doing comics or illustration is like the work you do puts it out in the world and it gets more work and stuff. But comics, I'm not like, I don't do editorial illustration. I basically, any illustration I do, you can look at and it basically just like a still from a comic. That's how I think about it. It's just terms in like visual storytelling. Like what can this scene be? I'm horrible at editorial illustration. Everything is sort of narrative based because I think in terms of stories, because I grew up, you know, with folks telling stories. I grew up loving stories and that's still there. That's present in kind of everything I do, I think.
Well, I want to make sure I avoid spoiling anything, but at the end of Odessa, it says to be continued. How long should readers expect to wait till the story is continued?
Yeah. That is another question I get a lot. It's on the back burner right now. In between when I was working on Odessa and now I signed a 2-book deal with Candlewick, with Walker, and they're taking very, very good care of me. And so those books are kind of what are in front of me. But Odessa, you know, it's not a series, it's 2 books. I have the ending, you know, the next book, it's been plotted out. The middle is a little murky, but I have the end. I'm really proud of the ending I have, and I'm really excited for it. It'll at least be a couple of years, but it's a story I want to finish, and I'm just really proud of where it is in my head. Hopefully it'll be as good as I want it, but you know, I just have some things that are kind of on my plate right now.
Well, is there anything else on the horizon that you're comfortable talking about?
I'm super excited for these books for Walker that I'm doing. I get to work with Susan Van Meter, who is an amazing editor. And the next one will probably come out 2022, so in 2 years. And that is called True Tales of a Seventh Grade Lizard Boy. You know, it's a middle reader book, and it's sort of taking, this book is going to be taking the trope of sort of the lizard people and kind of paralleling it with sort of the immigrant experience and what it's like to have to sort of like wear a new mask, wear a new face, and sort of exist, you know, in a world that kind of sees you in a very, very specific way. So I did the second draft of that. I'm waiting to get edits back and I should be drawing it soon. You know, books take a long time, but that's sort of the next project and it'll be a couple of years from now, but I'm super excited for that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And my guest today has been Jonathan Hill. He's an illustrator, educator, comics artist, and author of the graphic novel, Odessa. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you so much. It's been so great being here. And, you know, I was talking about a book being apocalyptic in an apocalyptic world, but it seems like there's a little hope in the future. And I think that that's a big thing to look forward to.
Well, on that note, for our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more?
Oh, you can find me at basically one of the Johns everywhere. It's O-N-E-O-F-T-H-E-J-O-H-N-S. There is no H in my name, but there is in all my handles. So oneofthejohns.com, Twitter, Instagram, one of the Johns. Yeah, you should be able to find me there.
And how about literary arts and the Portland Book Festival?
Yes, I mean, the book festival is going on until the 21st. They have something for everyone. And I love the way Amanda picks panels and pairs authors together. It's free, it's open to the public. Portland Book Fest, I think it's pdacbookfest.org, literaryarts-arts.org. It's supposed to be, if you miss a panel or you can't see it because you're doing something, they are recording them, and I'm sure that they'll be up soon.
Well, thanks again, and thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and at kboo.fm. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
I want to reach the western lands, right in front of you across the bubbling brook. It's a frozen sewer. It's known as the Doohad, remember? All the filth and horror, fear, hate, disease, and death of human history flows between you and the western land. How long does it take a man to learn that he does not and cannot want what he wants? You have to be in hell to see heaven. Glimpses from the land of the dead. Flashes of serene, timeless joy. A joy as old as suffering and despair.